38. I'm not sure where to aim. Sul Kalu knows we're here, and he needs to be put down. He's as close to pure evil as I've ever seen. But he's also got the cat's full attention. I have little doubt it was stalking the three of us, but now it has eyes for the giant. The cat's spotted gray fur slides over its muscles as it creeps nearer. While it's closer to the ground than the giant, pound for pound, I'd put them in the same class. The giant has human intelligence, I'm assuming, and impressive strength on his side. But the saber-tooth has massive paws hiding long, retractable claws and a pair of 11-inch-long canines. Of the two, the cat would appear to have the advantage. It's built for hunting in the cold. But Sul Kalu, god of the hunt, has proven himself to be more than savage. So I don't point my gun at either of them. The only way we all survive this battle is to not be here when it ends. I raise an open palm to Flores and Kuznetsky, ordering them to do the same. Sul Kalu catches my eye, gives me a wry smile, like he's in on a joke at my expense, and then turns his full attention to the cat. His confidence unnerves me. The cat stops its approach, lowering itself into the snow, muscles coiled. Its back end twitches back and forth. Eyes narrowing, its focus is unflinching, until the giant leans forward and bellows. The sound shakes through me, using my eardrums as punching bags. The cat flinches back, its ears folding down tighter. Its massive jaws open, letting out a much quieter but no less threatening hiss. As intimidating as Sul Kalu might be, the saber-tooth isn't backing down. It doesn't see the giant as a potential meal. It sees him as competition infringing on its territory. Like all predators, it will fight to the death, even when the odds are against it, to protect its hunting grounds and the prey within them, which right now includes us. With surprising speed, the cat launches from the snow. Sul Kalu raises his forearm to block the attack and quickly learns it was the wrong move. The cat's massive canines pierce the forearm, punching through one side and slipping out the other. Instead of a flash of pain in the giant's eyes, I see pleasure. Then they fall back into the snow, the cat's rapid-fire claws raking at the giant's sides. And he doesn't scream. Not once. With the battle fully engaged, I shout, "Enola!" I take a step closer to where the giant had been digging, but I don't have to get any closer or repeat her name. She crawls from a subterranean den, likely maintained by some Ice Age creature that's made itself scarce. Her face twists in revolt when she sees the giant and the cat locked in mortal combat, but then she run-trudges through the snow. She's shivering hard, her meager clothing not up to the task of fending off the frigid endless winter, but she's still clutching the Winchester. Why didn't she shoot it? I wonder, but I decide now is not the time to ask. I shed my jacket and wrap it around her. Let's move. Kuznetsky doesn't need to be told twice, but Flores wavers. We could kill it now, both of them. He's right. Between the four of us, we could probably make sure neither beast walks away from this. But I suspect neither of them will already, and Enola is hypothermic and in danger of losing some fingers and toes if we don't get her warmed up. The people we can save are more important than the ones we can kill. Flores smiled. That was the first time you sounded like him, like you. And what would he have said if one of his people wasn't immediately obeying an order? I ask, helping Enola uphill past Flores. Move your fucking ass, soldier, I finish for him. That's the line. Flores falls in behind Enola and me, watching our six, or maybe just watching the battle unfold. I don't turn back to look, but I can hear enough. Tearing flesh, breaking bones, the savage cat's roar. The most unnerving thing about the audio savagery is that through it all, Sul Kalu never makes a sound. No scream of pain, no roar of anger, just silence. Part of me wants to believe it's because he's dead, that the cat's initial attack did him in, and now it's just venting on his body. But I don't think that's the case. The giant's confident eyes burn in my mind. He knew he would survive, and that smiling stare was a promise that we'd meet again. The uphill climb through knee-deep snow feels like a dream. Arms and legs pumping hard, getting nowhere, the monster creeping up behind us. But every time I look back, the forest is clear, and we're making actual progress. I lose sight of Kuznetsky, but find him again, waiting by the open hatch. He's got the AA-12 pressed against his shoulder and aims straight at me when we round a tree. For a moment, I think he's betrayed us, but then he sighs and lowers the weapon. "Hurry up," he says, shivering more from fright than the cold. Enola stumbles in the snow, falling to her knees. I can't imagine how tired she must be. As I wrap my arm around her waist and hoist her back up, Flores arrives and supports her on the other side. Together, we hustle the remaining 10 feet to the open hatch. "Go in first," I say to Flores. "Support her weight while I lower her down."
"I can do it,"
Enola says, her defiant strength showing even while her eyes start to close. As Flores lowers himself into the hatch, a howl rolls through the forest, and it's definitely not the saber-toothed cat. Tsul'Kalu has won the brawl of giants, but he must be injured. Those teeth through his arm should be enough to slow him down, never mind the lacerations on his sides. If he doesn't bleed out and die right now, infection will get him. He wouldn't be the first god to die in battle with a great beast. Of course, we're early enough in human history that he might now be one of the first. Flores climbs halfway down the ladder and then reaches up. I brace myself on either side of the hatch and lower Enola down. My muscles twitch from the effort, but not because she's heavy. The cold is seeping through my jacketless clothing, constricting my muscles and skin. The promise of warmth rises up from the tunnel below. The subterranean air isn't exactly warm, but the ground's natural insulation keeps the tunnels at a relatively balmy 55 degrees.
"I have her,"
Flores says. I slowly release Enola and watch her slide down, guided by Flores and received by my father.
"We heard howling,"
Owen says from below. "Nothing to worry about," I say, feeling just a little bad for lying to myself. Owen looks relieved, but Cassie is unconvinced. Her jaw is clenched tight, and she's doing a tension-filled, impatient jig. If not for her serious eyes and the gun in her hand, I think she'd had to pee. I step back and nod my head to future Kuznetsky.
"After you, princess," he manages a smile. "Only way I'm going to gain everyone's trust is to not be a dick, right?"
He's right, but the question remains, why is he trying to gain our trust? Is he one of the good guys, or will he betray us?
"Besides," he says, "if I don't let you go first, I'm pretty sure Cassie will nut punch. Look out!"
He shoves me into the snow. I don't see what happens next, but I hear it. A wet smack is followed by a wheezy groan. One of the saber-toothed cat's teeth, root and all, protrudes from his chest. It's a kill shot right over his heart. He's still standing. Still conscious, but with his heart no longer pumping blood, he's got just seconds left to live. And he uses them to save me.
"Go!"
he shouts, raising the AA-12 downhill and holding down the trigger. The weapon thunders as it cycles through shotgun shells at nearly 2 cartridges per second. Tsul'Kalu howls as the screaming horde of metal pellets chews through his skin. Flowers of purple blood burst across his body. For a moment, I'm stunned. Purple blood? What I once saw as a giant aberration, I now know isn't remotely human. The way he charges through the gunfire without flinching, without losing his demented smile, chills me more than the Ice Age air.
"I'm sorry,"
I say to Kuznetsky, "for not trusting him. For leaving him to die, for the scars on his body, for his sacrifice, regardless of whether or not he intended to betray us." Then I dive beneath the shotgun, slide into the hatch, and fall to the floor below. The impact knocks the air from my lungs, leaving me a breathless, heaving mess, but it doesn't stop me from looking back up. The AA shotgun clicks empty. 32 cartridges fired into the core of what looks like a man, but is not. With his dying breath, future Kuznetsky screams, but the sound is muffled when a giant hand wraps around his head. Holding him up in the air, Tsul'Kalu steps into view above the hole, looking down, still smiling.
"Alatizdi Tsizdu."
"Everyone in the carts,"
I say, using my first real breath to issue the order. Flores yanks on me to follow my own command, but I remain rooted in place, locked onto Tsul'Kalu's eyes. With a quick squeeze, future Kuznetsky's life comes to an end with a pop. Blood and gore ooze out between the giant's fingers. My resolve falters, and Flores pulls me away. I all but collapse into the cart, propped up by the still-living younger Kuzneski, who looks as disturbed by what he's seen as I am. Perhaps even more so. He now knows what his own death might look like. Especially if Tsul'Kalu finds us again. At close range, the AA-12 hit harder than our handguns and the Winchester combined. I'm not sure we'll be able to kill it.
Go, go, go!
Flores says, and both carts speed away, heading downhill through the tunnel, no destination in mind other than getting the hell away. We're chased by a deafening howl, reverberating through the tunnel. With distance and time, I collect myself. A minute into our flight, I recover enough to sit up. I lean forward to check on Enola. She's huddled in the front beside my father, who is behind the wheel, and she's held by my younger self in a valiant effort to warm her up. Her eyes crack open and she whispers,
"Thank you."
I acknowledge her with a nod and say, "Alatizdi tsizdu." Do you know what it means? She frowns, sags a bit, and then recovers enough strength to say,
"Run, rabbit,"
before falling asleep.